coming up on New York Now.
Unless you want the nation to say you die and no coverage. We can do that, but don't count on my vote.
We'll take you to a town hall with upstate Congressman Paul Tonko and John Campbell of the USA Today Network and Ken Lovett of the Daily News. Join us at the Reporters Roundtable.
The U.S. Attorney's Office out of Brooklyn is looking into it to see whether or not there should be a full-blown investigation. The state attorney general is also looking into it. So people are, you know, this is an issue that's not going away so quickly.
It's next on New York Now, right here on PBS.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET. Winner of a New York State Emmy for Best Political Program. This is New York Now.
Welcome to New York Now. I'm Casey Seiler from the Times Union. My partner, Matt Ryan, will join us in just a bit. But we're starting this week's show at the Reporters Roundtable, where I'm happy to be joined by Ken Lovett from the Daily News and John Campbell from the USA Today Network. All right, gentlemen, we have 3 weeks to go before the end of the legislative session. I would posit that it seems that scandal and or controversy are seem to be overshadowing the conclusion of this week's session, in particular the Lulu scandal, the controversy over stipends that were paid to people who perhaps should not have received them, specifically state senators in the Republican Conference and the Independent Democratic Conference. Ken, you reported earlier this week that at least one subpoena has gone out from the office of the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District.
Right. A subpoena went to the Senate looking for information, documents to see how these were paid out, what, you know, why potentially. It's not clear whether they've brought anyone in yet. I haven't heard that they have. But certainly the U.S. Attorney's Office out of Brooklyn is looking into it to see whether or not there should be a full-blown investigation. The state attorney general is also looking into it. So people are, you know, this is an issue that's not going away so quickly.
Yeah, and it's you're right. It is overshadowing things. There's no doubt about that. And there's only a few weeks left in the legislative session. That is going to play a big role. How the governor seems to not be showing too much interest in the end of the legislative session. That's going to play a big role, whether he decides to jump in and try to get something passed or push anything at the end of the session. That'll make a big difference. But clearly the Lulu scandal is really the big shadow over the whole thing.
Go ahead, yeah.
We should note, too, that while the AG and the U.S. attorney are looking into it, one person who is not is Albany County District Attorney David Soares, someone who's been criticized over the years for all the corruption we've seen out of Albany. His office has done very little, if nothing, to deal with it. And he met with the Senate Democrats to talk about this and then decided, apparently, that, no, he's not going to look into it.
Yeah, Soares, as you note, has always said, well, we, you know, my office really doesn't have the resources. We have to stick with crime in Albany County. He was, of course, a member of Governor Cuomo's snake bit, I think is the fair adjective, Moreland Commission to investigate public corruption, and apparently, you know, begged, just give me one referral, you know, out of that effort, but nothing bupkis came from it.
Nothing, and we've seen others, you know, Preet Bharara, the former U.S. attorney out of Manhattan, took all the files and ran with it, but Soares, nothing.
John, you noted your difficulty at finding like something that might be kind of the big idea for the end of session is telling. I mean, what could it be? These guys have 3 weeks to go. We've seen big uglies at this stage before start to come together. Is it going to be some kind of little ugly? And what might be in it?
There's always something. The one thing that is looming is the mayoral control for New York City, of New York City schools. That's something that comes up every year now. The Senate Republicans, you know, are a frequent foe of New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio and, you know, aren't just going to give that away. I'm sure they're going to be looking for something in return. You've already seen the Assembly Democrats tie that to sales tax extenders, which are just usually pro forma measures that are passed every 2 years to allow counties and certain cities to increase, not increase, but maintain their sales tax levels. I mean, that is looming out there, but that's something that, that comes up every year now. And you haven't really seen a push for some sort of, there's no big looming issue other than that.
That's
although,
the only one that's left
exactly.
That they have to do. Anything else doesn't have to get done. There's talk about potential procurement reform. Mm-hmm. I doubt we'll see it, but it's possible. Depends how much they want to go to war with Governor Cuomo, because he's going to fight that one. The legislature wants to try and restore some of the oversight for economic development projects to the comptroller, something that was stripped away at the governor's behest in 2011. There's been scandals now, especially upstate, with the economic development programs, and the legislature and DeNapoli say it's time to give that back. The governor is fighting it. Can they come to a compromise? Who knows? If not, if the legislature is ornery, they could pass it and either force the governor to sign it or veto it and then set up potentially the first override of his 7 years in office.
John, I think it's fair to say that early in your career at the Capitol, you were one of the best reporters covering the controversy over hydrofracking. As you now enter your middle years at the Capitol, I think it's fair to say that one story that you have owned is the dispute between the Cuomo administration and federal transportation officials over signs that have been popping up on the major highways of this great state that the feds find to be non-conforming with federal guidelines, to wit, they are too numerous and too distracting.
Too numerous, too distracting. The guidelines. They're not really guidelines. They're rules that states have to follow in order to get federal funding for their highway system. Which is, in New York State, we're talking about $1.7 billion a year. And the feds and the state have been battling for years now behind the scenes about these signs, about rest stops at throughways highway rest stops that don't conform with federal law as well. And it keeps coming back up. The feds sent a letter to the Department of Transportation Commissioner in New York, Matthew Driscoll, earlier this month saying, hey, you told us we were going to have some sort of plan to resolve this issue in the beginning of April. We still don't have anything. What's going on? And it's on the one hand, it's kind of a silly dispute over highway signs, but on the other hand, we're talking about millions and millions of dollars that the state could be jeopardizing just by having these signs up. So it's a matter of who blinks. Do the feds come in and take away highway funding, or does the state take the signs down?
All of these signs, by the way, or it seems most of them, tout things that are near and dear to the heart of one man, who's Governor Andrew Cuomo.
Yes, absolutely.
Lots of Taste New York, his other initiatives.
He's defended it. He was involved back in 2014. He announced it in his state address after the feds had already said, no, you can't put these up. He came out and put it in his state of the state and said, hey, we're going to put these signs up everywhere. And that's what we've seen. I mean, I'm sure everybody watching this who's from the state of New York has seen those signs at somewhere. So long as they hop in a car every other day or something. So it's, it's who blinks first. And so far, both sides are kind of half blinking, I guess. I don't know.
Although the feds are looking to save as much money as they can. So I wouldn't assume they're going to blink on this at this point. You have a budget that's going to cut, a lot of money. And, this isn't a ton of money in the scope of things, but it is money they can save if they really wanted to go after the state.
The big news nationally and, of course, globally this week is President Trump's decision on Thursday to pull out of the Paris Climate Change Accord. Governor Cuomo, I think it's fair to say, leapt kind of to the front of the parade going in the other direction by announcing that, first of all, that New York is going to keep what it can of its commitments to the Paris Accords, and also that he was forming a climate change alliance for states that wanted to go that route with California Governor Jerry Brown and Jay Inslee of Washington.
And it would not surprise me when we talk about the end of session, and I don't know he's going to do this, but it wouldn't surprise me if the governor comes out with some kind of package, environmental package. This is what he likes to do. There's going to be a lot of stories that says, well, the legislature is going to end with a whimper, and he doesn't always like that. He likes things being done. I can see him putting out some kind of environmental package to capitalize on this whole situation.
And in terms of New York's climate goals, the U.S. withdrawing from the Paris Accord really doesn't have any impact at all on what New York had already set for its goals, because they already exceeded what the federal government was looking for. The federal government agreed to cut about 28% of greenhouse gas emissions by 2025 based on 2005 levels. The state since 2009 has had a goal of cutting 80% from 1990 levels, which are lower than 2005 levels, by 2050. So it's the state's goals remain in place, and they already exceeded what was in the Paris Accord.
The Paris Accord, if Trump goes ahead with pulling out of it completely, that can't be accomplished until after 2020. Does that mean that the climate change accords now really rises to the top in terms of environmental issues for the 2020 presidential election? And what does that mean for potential members of that contest, such as Governor Cuomo?
Well, I think it becomes a top environmental issue. How much that's really going to impact the overall race, however, is another question. I mean, I'm not quite sure people are going to vote on that issue. You know, it didn't appear that way in the last election that, you know, when Trump talked about pulling out of it. So
that being said, every single congressional member who's going to be up for election next year is going to have to take a position on it one way or the other. And that's difficult for a lot of Republicans in particular and maybe some of these more marginal districts.
Right, in certain states. But in certain states, you know, this plays extremely well.
Well, to that point, upstate on Thursday, the day of Trump's announcement, we had statements from Elise Stefanik and John Faso, both of whom are in those districts that are, generally speaking, kind of purplish. Elise Stefanik's North Country district was represented, you know, by a Democrat in recent years. Both of them saying that they thought that Trump's decision was a mistake, that it was misguided. They are both members of a bipartisan, you know, climate progress alliance. Is Trump going to see those types of members of Congress or even members of the Senate walking away from him?
I don't know. I don't know. If it's not this, it might be something else. I mean, it's every single time the president does take some sort of action like this, they're going to have to take a position. So, you know, do they reach a breaking point at some point? Who knows? That remains to be seen. But every single one of these types of decision makes it harder in some circles, in some of those more marginal districts, to stick with the president on this kind of stuff.
But if you're in an area where Trump is popular,
absolutely,
then this, you know, his numbers are down overall, but he's still popular among his base, and this plays into that, his base.
Chris Collins comes to mind. Chris Collins is in probably the reddest district in the entire state of New York, and he is a very, very vocal Donald Trump supporter. I don't believe we've seen anything from him on the Paris Accord yet, but he's in one of those safe, Trump-backing districts that allows him to stay aligned with the president.
Very quickly at the end, we're talking Friday morning. Bill Mahoney of Politico New York reported that a subpoena was sent to the state Senate Republican Campaign Committee looking for information about dollars that went out from its housekeeping account. That came from the Board of Elections independent counsel, Risa Sugarman. Could that be yet another scandal, perhaps burdening the end of session?
Certainly, it's not a good thing for the Senate Republicans as they're trying to keep control of the chamber. Scott Reif, their spokesman, called it a political witch hunt. I wouldn't expect him to say anything else. But they certainly weren't criticizing Sugarman of politics when she went after Mayor de Blasio down in New York City. So we'll have to see where it leads. It's just breaking now.
All right. Well, that is where we're going to have to leave it. Thanks very much to Ken Lovett, a past winner of the Walter T. Brown Award from the LCA alumni, and to John Campbell of USA Today Network, who is this year's winner of that selfsame award.
Well
Thanks
deserved.
Very much. Well deserved indeed. All right, and now we'll kick it to Matt at the desk.
All right, thanks, Casey. Members of Congress return to Washington in a few days after an extended holiday break. Upstate, there weren't a lot of your traditional town halls. Tom Reed, who has been the most accessible Republican representative from New York, planned on holding four in his Finger Lakes district on Saturday. And Paul Tonko, a Democrat, held his third of the year in suburban Albany this week. In this case, the town hall was the opposite of what you've come to expect here in 2017.
On any healthcare bill that...
Wait a minute, one response.
Screaming, yelling, and booing has become commonplace during these meetings over the last decade. But what does one look like when it's a member of Congress in the minority in a safe district? In this case, pretty quiet and pretty empty. Representative Paul Tonko is a familiar face in the Capital Region. Before going to Congress, he was a state assemblyman for over two decades. He hasn't been seriously challenged since he was first elected in 2008.
As we move forward with tonight's town hall event, I would ask first and foremost that we agree to be respectful.
That would not be an issue.
I would say a majority of us feel it probably in this room fortunate to have you as a representative. And you really are, in essence, preaching to the choir for many of us.
Tonko faced a mostly friendly crowd. The questions were familiar topics. Education.
What will you do and how can I help you counter some of the budget cuts that DeVos is suggesting regarding school lunches and all the wraparound services that many of our co-students need?
Russia.
My question is, why would Russia interfere with American affairs?
The environment.
The Paris Agreements. Mm-hmm. Climate change is real, it's man-made. What are you going to do and what can we do to combat what I'm assuming we're just going to pull out of it as a country, not by our choice, but what we do, what we can do to combat that?
And numerous questions on healthcare.
I'm wondering if you, what you think about single-payer healthcare.
As far as the ACA, any limits for individuals with pre-existing conditions, if there's a limit for that, that's just unacceptable. So if there's cuts that are on the way for people with, you know, those sufferings, also limits for individuals with substance abuse issues. We're hearing that there is possibly cuts in the Affordable Care Act for that. And with mental issues, there's also talk of cuts along those realms. We just want to express our concern about those cuts.
The most interesting exchange was with a younger gentleman who had comments on the Congressional Budget Office's evaluation of the American Health Care Act.
I'd like to point out that when you say that 23 million people would be denied health care, quoting from the CBO report, it says that most of the increase would stem from repealing the penalties associated with the individual mandate. So most of the initial 14 million that would lose their health care would be doing so voluntarily. And also I'd like to ask how exactly you can classify health care as a right.
Well, I think that based on what other civilized nations and industrialized nations have done, you know, I think that it serves the human interest to be able to have access and affordability, accessibility and affordability to a healthcare system standardized, personalized to you. I see that as a right for the people of this nation. You should not have to resort. I don't think you should have to resort to a mayonnaise jar on a convenience store counter to conquer your latest healthcare challenge. I just don't think that's American. I don't think it's moral, and I don't think it's the right approach. In terms of your suggestion that if you lose the subsidy, then it's your right to go with it. It's about affordability. The subsidies brought people in a wise way, to a connection to healthcare. And I think that serves all of us. It's not good for the taxpayer, it's not good for the ratepayer in the insurance side to have this haphazard approach where people are going into an emergency room as their primary care, seeing different doctors with each visit. And the subsidies were meant to provide stability and certainty. So yeah, it's their choice. If you take that subsidy away, go without health insurance. What kind of choice is that? This is about making it possible for families to get into the preventative mode, to get into the acute care, hospitalized care in a way that will stabilize them. And in the long term, that is the best thing for society. It's the best thing for the taxpayer. It's the best thing for the insurance rate payer because you're having a much more sound system, a much more effective system. So if 14 million people losing their health care in the first year is rationalized by their inability to pay, you know, we're into this for, I think, a humanistic spin and making certain that connection is there and making certain that the actuarial balance is helpful. You have a number of people who are healthy, who can't afford the healthcare policy. So they're not going to weigh down the system and drain it because of healthcare needs. They're healthy, but they're poor. So that mix included provides for the kind of actuarial outcome that is about insurance in general. Community rating tells you it's about community. The broader the audience, the better the outcome. But this is providing stability for those who don't have the affordability. And we offer it, if we don't pay now, we pay later in bad debt and charity that goes to the hospitals, who many will take on everybody and anybody, but they don't get covered for that service. And then we contribute as taxpayers to bad debt and charity. So eventually it comes back to bite us. And I don't agree with your logic.
I think you just misunderstood my question a little bit, in that the $14 million, like under the Affordable Care Act, there's the individual mandate, and so you're under penalty of a fine if you don't buy healthcare on your own, if you don't have healthcare. When the penalties for not having healthcare get repealed, then there will be certain healthy people that decide not to then buy healthcare, and that's where the majority of the initial $14 million will fall out. It's not that they're being denied health care, it's that they choose not to because there's no penalty for not having it anymore.
You're young, you're healthy, you choose not to enter into the system. You have an accident and you're paraplegic. Somebody's going to pay for that. You could have a catastrophic illness impact you. You know, we've seen it. We've seen neighbors of all ages getting impacted suddenly. It's about requiring people to enter into a process that I think provides stability and an actuarial balance that is part of community.
I think it's important to make a distinction between whether you have a right to health care or whether you have a right to access, like the right to have access to health care, because they're two different things. Being able to buy health care versus having a right to healthcare, you don't really have a right to healthcare because that involves somebody else providing a service for you. You don't have a right to somebody else's labor. So then when you declare a right to healthcare versus a right to access healthcare, there's a difference in the outcome.
So you want me to pay more when there's a further complication down the road with bad debt and charity. So I'd pay now or pay later and pay a lot more later.
I was just asking about...
Yeah. Right, and I'm saying with that person in the system, they're connected in a standardized way to a medical team that will be their team, that will monitor them as they go through the ages and save us perhaps from outcomes that will be much more catastrophic down the road. So you'll pay eventually, unless you want the nation to say you die and no coverage. We can do that, but don't count on my vote.
While there wasn't any in East Greenbush on this night, Taco says he has watched the anger that has bubbled over in town halls across the country. He feels holding these, no matter if you are in the majority or minority, is an important way to bridge the political divide that has become so pronounced in the last decade.
I know that I gain a lot from these discussions, and I would hope the people attending do. And it helps to sharpen our thinking. It may modify our thinking. It may totally reverse our thinking. But the important thing is that we dialogue. That, you know, the town hall is a concept that goes back to our infancy as a nation. And it was those town halls that enabled people to best understand what we need to do as a group.
That leads us to this week's New York Now poll question. Are you happy with your current congressional representative? Let us know who it is and why you feel that way at nynow.org. Last time out, we asked your opinion about the Independent Democratic Conference, the breakaway Democrats that form a governing coalition with the Senate GOP. Many votes on this one, 85% of which say they felt mostly negative toward the group. Barb in Queens, watching on WNET, told us the IDC is circumventing the will of New York voters for their own profit and power. Joe in the Ridgewood neighborhood of Queens said, when someone sees Democrat on the ballot, they expect their representative to vote with the Democrats, not collude against them. Jen in South Salem, down in Westchester County, they were elected as Dems. They should caucus with Dems, otherwise they're GOP. We aren't stupid. And finally, Elaine and Manlius watching on WPBS. New York should be setting an example for the rest of the country, but the IDC is holding New York back. Thanks to all of our voters, and we hope to hear from you again this week at nynow.org. On the website, you can stream any of our past programs from the last 6 years. You can follow links to us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, where our handle is at nynow_PBS. You'll find a link to the Capital Confidential blog. It's also found at timesunion.com.
All right, well, the legislature returns to Albany next week. As mentioned at the roundtable, a sense of urgency, big ideas seem to be lacking at this point.
We talk about the big ugly, all this legislation that comes in at the end, but who knows? Karen DeWitt was doing a forum in Rochester, and she was wondering if, you know, Governor Cuomo was going to even be back here in June. But Joe Morelli, who is the number two in the assembly, said whether he's here or not, he will loom large.
He does loom large, without a doubt. All right, well, we'll have to see. We leave you today with shots from the city of my birth, the Queen City of Buffalo. I'm Casey Seiler.
And I'm Matt Ryan. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time right here on your local PBS station.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET.